From Cowdersport to Uniontown, Danville to York, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, with the state budget now more than a month overdue, mass transit advocates are ratcheting up their demands for more funding. Nathan Benefield from the Commonwealth Foundation is here with details. Inner city office vacancy rates remain high 5 years after the COVID-19 pandemic sent many workers home. Likewise, Pittsburgh has yet to recover, as we learn on this week's Allegheny Institute report. And the One Big Beautiful Bill Act has unleashed Pennsylvania's potential. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has stories from across Penn's Woods on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Nathan Benefield of the Commonwealth Foundation in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission recently approved $267,000 in raises for the commission's top executives, including an $86,000 per year raise for the Turnpike's CEO. A report from Penn Live found six Turnpike executives now make more than Governor Josh Shapiro, hauling in over $250,000 per year. It should be noted that Turnpike tolls, which pay those salaries, have increased steadily for over a decade as Turnpike debt has mounted. Those annual toll increases are expected to continue for the foreseeable future. Governor Josh Shapiro pledged during his 2022 campaign to give students and parents more school choice options. He has not kept that promise, but now he faces an interesting decision. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act gives parents more access to school choice, but states must opt into the program to allow parents to access the scholarship funding. As he faces re-election next year, Shapiro must decide whether or not students and parents in Pennsylvania will be able to access federal funding to help finance their education. Stay tuned. Hold on to your wallets. Despite passage over a decade ago of the so-called Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, health insurance costs have continued to rise. Now WESA Radio reports that Pennsylvanians may be about to face the biggest rate hike in years. Tentative plans for health insurance rates for individuals face a proposed 19% increase. Rates for small businesses could go up 13%. A decision is expected in September. The city of Philadelphia continues to be on the federal government's list of sanctuary cities. A recent news release from the U.S. Department of Justice cited the city's policy, saying, quote, it impedes enforcement of federal immigration laws and, quote, puts Americans at risk. In May, 16 Pennsylvania counties and cities were on the list of sanctuary communities. All have since been removed, leaving Philadelphia as the only Pennsylvania municipality impeding justice. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania's mass transit agencies make annual demands for more funding while stubbornly resisting any reforms to make their operations more efficient. This year, they are especially militant, with the state budget now being more than 1 month overdue. Here to discuss the situation is Nathan Benefield. Nate is Chief Policy Officer at the Commonwealth Foundation. Nate, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Nate, as typically happens in these circumstances, when an agency wants more funding, a lot of times they try to put pressure on lawmakers, on the budget makers, to get a deal done by going after those services and that are the most high profile or enact the most pain. As we look at mass transit funding, are we looking here at potential service cuts to try to force some sort of funding increase?
Yeah, that is exactly what is being threatened by SEPTA, the largest mass transit agency in the Philadelphia area, that they are saying, if we don't get an increase in state subsidy, and this is funding that would come from the state sales tax, they're going to have to cut routes. And they're threatening, one, routes of taking kids to school before the start of the school year. They're threatening route from the Eagles game, like, oh, no one's going to be able to get transport from the Eagles game and the home opener. And really the most popular bus routes and train routes, rather than looking at the things where people aren't riding and that are the most costly. So they really are using this leverage of threatening to cut down the most popular, most used service routes in order to try and get a greater subsidy from state taxpayers.
Are we hearing the same sort of soundings from other mass transit agencies, particularly the transit agency in Pittsburgh, relative to these types of tactics?
You're hearing a bit of that from the Pittsburgh area, not nearly as much, though, as from SEPTA. And really, most of the other rural transit agencies, not really anything. It really is being driven by this rhetoric by SEPTA out of Philadelphia, and the fact that they have really almost a dozen lobbying firms working for them in Harrisburg, that despite this whole complaint of lack of funding, they're spending millions of dollars in taxpayer money to hire lobbyists to go and get them more taxpayer funding from the state.
Well, that might be a good area to cut all the money going out the door to lobbyists. So we'd rather pay lobbyists and bus kids to school. That's an interesting approach here. In terms of their funding, Nate, do they have any sort of a point that they're underfunded? Have they not received significant funding increases year after year?
They have received significant funding increases. They claim that their shortfall is about $200 million in terms of their budget. But the reality is they're getting, in terms of just their operating budget, more than $1 billion from state taxpayers. That number has gone up, and going back a couple of decades, 2007, their state subsidies have gone up 169%. But on the other hand, their passenger revenue that they're actually charging people who are riding it is down 20%. And some of this was really the post-pandemic. People are simply not riding buses. But some of it is they're having issues with even collecting fares. There was an Inquirer story that just a few months ago that said they don't even know how many people are not paying every day. But they estimated by watching videos at stations that, I'm quoting, maybe 3 out of 10 people regularly paid a fare last year. 3 out of 10 paid, meaning 7 out of 10 are skipping, jumping the line to not pay and getting on these trains. Hey, maybe that is an issue. You should actually charge people who are riding transit before asking drivers from rural Pennsylvania to pay for it.
Well, you have that. And in terms of efficiencies here, I know the Commonwealth Foundation, the Allegheny Institute out in Pittsburgh, you all have done a lot of studies over the years recommending ways that these transit areas can be able to be more efficient, more effective in the funding that they already have. Have they made any strides in that direction?
They haven't even attempted to make strides in that, Loman. And in fact, SEPTA has not reevaluated their bus routes in 60 years. Which is just an astonishing length of time to not look at that and finding those efficiencies in the routes that are working and not. And partly is because most of their funding is from taxpayer subsidies. So they aren't trying to make a better market approach to their riders. No need to find efficiencies when all you need to do is go lobby for the state for more money.
What sort of efficiencies could they actually enact, Nate, that you and others think could actually allow them to operate with less money and still be able to maintain the level of service that they have?
I think you start with becoming more reliant on fares. They can, in fact, SEPTA is one of the least systems that is the least reliant on fares, more reliant on the state, to become more market-based and using rider fares to fund it, but also then, like, all right, where do people want to ride? Let's serve those areas there. Another area is safety, and that they really, like, people don't want to ride the bus or the trains because it's not safe. So focusing on that. And then really the bureaucracy there, that is one of the biggest areas of growth. Despite far fewer people riding it, they've grown the bureaucracy and oversight, and it is a place for patronage jobs that politicians get their friends jobs there. That really needs to be cut down and can provide mass transit service more efficiently and more connected to the people who are actually riding it.
We are talking with Nate Benefield, who is Chief Policy Officer at the Commonwealth Foundation. So far, we've been talking about the fact that SEPTA, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Regional Transit Authority, Pittsburgh Regional Transit, and others are asking for significant additional state financial resources, as we've just heard, without really implementing any reforms or economizing measures. And Nate, at the risk of our program turning into a radio version of the movie Groundhog Day, I want to bring up the whole issue of the state budget again. We've been literally talking about this for months in view of the fact that the state budget now more than a month overdue. You have your ear to the ground at the state capitol. Any progress toward actually getting a budget done?
No, it doesn't seem to really be much progress in coming to terms with this. And I'll take a step back of start with Governor Shapiro proposing a budget of lower $51.5 billion that really had almost a $5 billion deficit there, saying we're going to drain our reserves this year and enforce a tax hike next year has really been the sticking point of overspending. And I'll put this out there, you know, some new numbers that we have coming in, given it's now 1 month overdue with the state budget. We actually have our first month of revenue data coming in that state revenues have grown about 1.5% over last year, which is right on line with what the projections were of about 1.4% year-over-year growth. So the question is, how much should spending grow if revenues are growing at 1.5%? Well, Shapiro's proposal was 8% spending growth, which I think you can pretty much very well see why this has been such a tough budget of, hey, we can't grow spending at five times what the revenue growth is, but that's what's being proposed and being pushed, and why there's such a huge difference between where Governor Shapiro and the House Democrats are and where the Senate Republicans are.
There are a lot of policy issues that are intertwined with budget issues this year. There has been a hint of suggestion, I think coming mainly from the Senate Republican side, that perhaps we could go to the device of a budget for 6 months that keeps spending level from last year. And this has been tried in the past, has it not?
Yes, there have been years in the past where there was no agreement on a budget, and in order to let some of the funding flow, because a lot of the funding to school districts, to nonprofits, I can't go out until there is at least some agreement to do what has been called a 6 month budget or partial funding, knowing that hey, there is agreement that we're going to fund public schools at some level, we're going to fund human services at some level. There may be a disagreement over how much of an increase those things would get, but to allow funding to flow, this has happened in the past where they basically passed a budget that included half of the funding that they would normally have or half of last year's spending for those programs. To just kind of alleviate the short-term pressure while they continue to negotiate over this disagreement.
It is probably a fair bet that they're not going to spend less in those areas than what they did last year. It always seems to go up here, Nate. And in terms of revenue, the governor has proposed new revenue sources and has actually included in his projections the sources of revenue that do not currently exist. Part of the policy discussion is also placing some sort of a tax on skill games, perhaps legalizing and taxing recreational marijuana. Any movement on those particular issues?
The governor had proposed we're going to legalize and tax recreational marijuana. I think the Senate has basically said that's not happening. Certainly not the way the House actually passed a bill that would have the state government have marijuana stores. That was shot down the day after it was passed. That's not happening. The governor had proposed that we would get $1 billion more from corporations by going through something very complicated called mandatory combined reporting. Again, that's not going to happen and would never generate the kind of revenues that the governor proposed there. And he's also proposed, not necessarily tied directly to the budget, but has proposed a tax on energy production in Pennsylvania that would drive up electric bills and by charging the producers of energy there. It's another one that don't see happening, though he is certainly already in litigation over Governor Wolf's entrance into REGI, which is a tax on energy bills that would come to fruition if he would win that lawsuit. So there are a number of taxes out there that he is projecting having revenue to spend on, but that are certainly not on the tables in what is likely to ever pass the legislature.
Likely not one of the biggest issues on the table, but we have for many years been talking about the Lifeline Scholarship Program that would provide essentially school choice and revenue for students in the most failing school districts in Pennsylvania. It has been a priority of Senate Republicans. Any discussion as to whether that could make it into the budget finally this year?
That is something that is continuing to be discussed, and Senate Republicans have said, we support all educational options.
We have again been talking with Nate Benefield, who is Chief Policy Officer at the Commonwealth Foundation. Nate, we do have the Commonwealth Foundation on our show quite often, but tell us a little bit about it for folks who may not be familiar.
Yeah, we are a think tank, which means we are a public policy research and advocacy organization. We do a lot of research on the issues that are most important to the state, especially around state budget and finances. And all of that research is on our website at commonwealthfoundation.org.
Nate Benefield of the Commonwealth Foundation. Nate, thank you for taking time to be back with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Like cities nationwide, Pittsburgh has a high office vacancy rate as workers have not returned to the downtown or center city area in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Here with an Elegant Institute report look at the numbers are Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi. Eric?
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute, Frank Gamrat. Your recent policy brief talked about the first quarter downtown Pittsburgh vacancy rate. Can you give our listeners an idea of what the first quarter looked like?
Vacancy rates for office buildings in Pittsburgh's what we call Central Business District, but most people know it as the Golden Triangle, have been a bit of a concern for a long time, but especially since the pandemic. When the pandemic hit in 2020. A lot of companies shut down, sent their employees home, allowed them to work from home instead of coming into the office. And that culture is kind of stuck. I mean, here we are, 2025, and some firms are requiring their employees to go back, but a lot of them are still a little more flexible with space. Come in a couple days, you can stay home a couple days. But the end result really was these firms looked around and decided that, well, we don't really need the footage. We don't need the space that we once had. We're paying for empty space. Let's consolidate, let's move, let's downsize, whatever the phrase you want to use is. And they ended up, you know, moving around. And as a result, some of these buildings started to become more vacant. Now, again, the vacancy becomes an issue because a value of an office building depends on how much money it makes in rental. Vacant building means less value. Less value means they go to the local governments, the municipal school and county, and say, well, we want to challenge our assessment. A lot of companies have challenged the assessment and won. And as a result, the school district, the municipality, and the county have had to not only get less in revenues, but they've had to give refunds on years past when they quote-unquote overcharged these building owners. So it's become a pretty hot-button issue, and we've been keeping track of it since the pandemic. And so what we can say is in the first quarter of 2025, for all classes of buildings, the vacancy rate in downtown Pittsburgh was 21.8%. Now, it was about the same in the fourth quarter of 2024, up a little bit from 19-something percent in the third quarter of 2024, but you don't expect a lot of movement between quarters. So let's go back to 2021, which was still at the tail end of the pandemic, but still in the pandemic, it was 19.6%. Now that's all classes of buildings, A, B, C, and lower. A is what we call the trophy classes, and in class A, Pittsburgh was at 19.8% in the first quarter of 2025, but they were 18.1% in the first quarter of 2021. So what we did is we looked at a sample of other cities around the country. We have eight: Charlotte, Cincinnati, Columbus, Dallas, Los Angeles, New York, Raleigh, Durham, San Francisco. And the average vacancy rate for all classes in 2025 first quarter is 24. So Pittsburgh at 21.8 came out a little bit better. And the average in for the Class A buildings is 22.4. And again, at 19.8, Pittsburgh comes out a little bit better. So Pittsburgh's holding its own when it comes to vacancy rates compared to other cities. But this movement of, well, we need to somehow bring these vacancy rates down. Oh, I know, let's convert them to residential. It has sort of gained some legs, and it's caused a little bit of issues here in Pittsburgh because that's what we want to do, what we as in the ruling class, the government class, etc. And it's coming with a price tag that is unfortunately falling on the shoulders of taxpayers.
On that point, Frank, tell us a little bit about the ease of converting these office buildings to residential living.
Like I said, that's sort of become a bit of a call. Well, you can just convert to residential. The problem is it depends on the building and its age. Older buildings, which have fallen into Class B or lower categories, are more easily converted for a very simple reason. One, of course, is natural light. Older buildings pre-1970 relied on more natural light and, of course, homes like natural light. The second thing is something as simple as plumbing. You know, these buildings, these high-rises are sealed. And what do you do about condensation from a shower or cooking or something like that, because all of the plumbing tends to be in the center of the building. Class A and newer buildings are not very useful for conversion. conversion simply because it's relied more on fluorescent lighting, and you still have the plumbing issue. But you get into this notion of, well, physically, how easy is it going to be to individually plumb an apartment versus plumb a floor? Because all the bathrooms are in the center of the hallway. Well, when you're in your apartment, you want a bathroom off your bedroom, you want water in your kitchen, your laundry. And so with the older buildings, while they may have the natural light, maybe easier to plumb, you run into issues like foundations, you run into issues like age of brick and whatnot. And so these tend to be a stickier issue, and conversions just are not that simple. Now, we wrote a paper in last year in 2024 that looked at conversion of buildings. And older buildings, while they're more apt to being converted, they're more expensive to being converted, because with older buildings you just have some issues that you may not have thought of or expected to encounter until you got in there. And so we're not seeing much in the way of conversion. And now the additional problem that you have is increased interest rates, and you have increased prices of construction materials. Since 2020, those things have gone up. They really haven't come down yet. So we're finding it expensive. And as a result, here in downtown Pittsburgh, and I'm sure it's happened elsewhere across the state, the governor comes rolling in late 2024, and they unveil a $600 million downtown renovation project that has three buildings on conversion watch. And the governor has posed some money towards them. One, of course, being the YWCA in downtown Pittsburgh. And it was going to be 30% of the apartments was in that one building. But because of the interest rates and construction costs, that seems to be scuttled for now, as a lien has been put on that building. But the governor came in and promised money for conversions that really the taxpayers have no business in underwriting.
So what role should the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania be playing in downtown Pittsburgh or any other downtown in Pennsylvania?
There's two things that the government can really do to help out the office market. One, provide an environment where businesses can thrive, where businesses can grow, new businesses can come in. In downtown Pittsburgh, and I'm sure downtown Philadelphia and some of the other core cities of the Commonwealth, you have such an old mentality of, well, you're a successful business, you need to pay more, you pay your fair share, we'll levy taxes on this, that, and the other, we'll put up regulations on things like sick leave, prevailing wages, and all that kind of stuff. And that sort of keeps businesses out. The second thing, and probably the easiest one for most governments to combat, would then be the environment, the panhandling, the homelessness, the drug use. A lot of businesses in downtown Pittsburgh since 2020 have cited that as reasons for leaving the downtown. There was a local restaurant that moved because he got tired of cleaning up crack pipes and needles in his doorway and watching people having a good time in doorways. He got tired of that kind of element, people stealing food off the counters because it was a walk-in hot dog shop. He moved out to another area into the U.S. Steel building where he feels more comfortable, more safe. Providing these businesses, and quite frankly, the visitors of downtown, whether they be business or leisure, they need to feel safe. People need to feel like if they walk down the street, they're not going to be assaulted, mugged, or asked for money. And whether that's real or perceived, it's a perception that's on right now that these local governments can really actively step up and handle without a whole lot of trouble.
Frank, great stuff as always, and we always encourage our listeners to visit our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, to read this brief and others. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi. This has been the Allegheny Institute Report on Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
The One Big Beautiful Bill Act is unleashing the potential of Pennsylvania's small businesses. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania chronicles a few of them on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Take a drive across Pennsylvania, across our rolling farmland, forested mountains, and the small towns in between. What you'll see is this. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act is doing something rare in politics. It's unleashing our Commonwealth's potential. Meet Dan, a third-generation farmer maintaining the land that his grandfather established decades ago. The agriculture industry has been through tough seasons, and without the provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act being made permanent, the businesses wouldn't be able to make critical infrastructure repair, and farming equipment would be rendered outdated and inoperable. As Dan puts it, this is a win for small business owners and the American farmer. Drive west to Butler County, and you'll find William, a dairy farmer whose family has been in the business since the 1800s. For him and his family, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act was a game changer. The provisions of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that were made permanent in this year's One Big Beautiful Bill Act allowed for his family farm to build a new grain bin. As William puts it, My family and I would not have had the confidence to have a project like this done if it wasn't for the One Big Beautiful Bill to help us with a project like this to improve our grain holding capacity. If we don't have quality food here, then we can't have a growing nation like we have now. In Washington County, meet Mark, CEO of an engineering company just south of the city of Pittsburgh. Mark recalls the benefits that the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provided for his business. More employees, greater wages, and more. Now, with these provisions being made permanent, his company is already hiring 3 new project managers and a new sales technician. His company is now expanding into new markets, something that couldn't be done without small business tax relief being made permanent by our leaders in Washington. In his testimony, Mark shares, "We're off to the races." And finally, in Cumberland County, there's Bill, a contractor who reminds us that real growth starts at home, literally. His clients are expanding and remodeling because they're keeping more of their hard-earned money in their pockets thanks to tax provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act being made permanent. For Bill, as a small business owner, these provisions allow him to invest more in his equipment. All in all, this is a win-win for taxpayers and contractors. One thing remains true. This bill didn't just happen because politicians in D.C. woke up one day and decided to do the right thing. It happened because we, the people, made it happen. Across the country, and especially here in Pennsylvania, grassroots activists showed up in force. Americans for Prosperity's Protect Prosperity campaign mobilized like never before. Our activists knocked on 500,000 doors, made 500,000 calls, and educated constituents in every corner of the country. Instead of waiting around to see how Washington addressed our dire economic crisis, our activists organized. As a result, they pushed this bill over the finish line all the way to the president's desk. This bill was carried over the finish line by small business owners who have been grappling with the past 4 years of top-down Biden-era policies. This bill was championed by taxpayers who knew that we couldn't afford a $2,400 tax hike. They partnered with us at Americans for Prosperity and delivered a huge victory for the American people. This is what the principle of mutual benefit is all about. When people are free to embrace their entrepreneurial spirit, they tend to help others along the way. Not because the law tells them to, but because that's how value is created in a free society. In rural communities, in small towns, on shop floors, and on dairy farms, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act is giving people something that's been in short supply for too long, the ability to live out their American dream and pursue their passions. That's what fuels Dan, William, Mark, and Bill to partner with Americans for Prosperity, the pursuit of the American dream. Head to americansforprosperity.org to sign your name to a petition thanking your member of Congress for making our tax cuts permanent and share your American dream story. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
And if you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WDAD-AM and WLCY-FM in Indiana, along with WIOO-FM and Red 102.3 in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.